Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Legends of the Spire. I'm currently sat on my old Saltergate seat in the garden, which seems rather apt, as the guy we have on the podcast today, I spent many a time watching him play from this very seat. Yes, we have Aaron Downes on the podcast in episode 3. He joins us from his home in Torquay to talk about his time with the Spireites. He joined us in 2004, after coming from Australia as a teenager and wanting to make his way in English League football. He got his opportunity under Roy McFarland and spent 8 years at the club, only leaving us in 2012. He then went on to have a successful career both at Cheltenham and Torquay, and like I said, is now back at Torquay as their assistant manager and going great runs. So I hope you enjoy our chat with Aaron Downes. Just before we start the episode, I'd like to say that if you are on social media, then please do tag us in on Twitter at Spire Legends if you wish to do so. If there's any players you'd love to see on the podcast, then please do add them in as well. There's plenty more episodes to come, and I'd love your thoughts on who you'd like to see next. So welcome and enjoy episode 3 of Legends of the Spire with Aaron Downes.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Aaron.
Not a problem.
So you've got a long association with the club.
Yes.
What, about 8 years, I think, you're at the club. But it all started back in, was it 2003 that you came to the UK?
2004. Yeah, 2004. Yeah.
So what was that like coming to the UK?
It was good. A young 18-year-old, sort of fresh from Australia, sort of with all these, you know, dreams and ambitions. And you come over and, I just wanted to, I've always sort of, you know, as a young player in Australia, I always wanted to play in England. My dad's born in England and, you know, spoke about, you know, when he lived over here, he moved when he was 10, so he didn't spend long over here. But so I always wanted to be a footballer, always wanted to play in England. When the opportunity came to go to Bolton Wanderers on trial, I jumped at it and took it with both hands and come over, and it didn't work out, unfortunately. But I was fortunate enough to have some family in the country and went and stayed with some family in West Yorkshire and end up playing for Frickley just on a non-contract just to keep fit because I had a few, this was in sort of April time. So I had a few opportunities in the summer, but not many people were taking trialists on at sort of that stage of the season. Obviously, with season nearly ending. So I played at Frickley just to keep fit and get some games in and play some football. And I was fortunate enough to play with Lee Richardson's brother. And he goes, you know, do you know what, Aaron? You know, I think you'd do a job at my brother's place, you know, and at Chesterfield. So Lee Richardson at the time was the assistant manager and Roy McFarland was manager. So I went on trial in the summer and, got signed up. And I originally signed, I think I signed a three-month deal. At the end of the 3 months, they added another 3 months. And then they ended it to the end of the season. And then it just carried on and I just kept renewing my contract then. So it was good. It was difficult in the first couple of years, to keep going, but I was, you know, desperate to do it. And it was nice. So it was good to get that first contract sorted.
Yeah. And it's all about determination, I suppose, isn't it? Like signing under Roy McFarland, I'm guessing he kind of put you under his wing a bit, kind of being same positionally when he was a player. What was it like working under him?
It was brilliant to have such a experienced manager. If I'm honest, when I first signed, I wasn't aware of the the stature in the game that Roy McFarland has, and obviously his career and things like that. Because obviously, a fresh-faced 18-year-old from Australia doesn't really know too much of the history of the game. So I knew more about rugby league players than I did about football players. So as much as I love the game, Once I got to learn and research and understand the gaffer's influence in the game and what he'd done in his career, it was, you know, you really took note of what he said. And he was a great man manager. I felt, you know, he knew how to motivate. He knew how to sort of pressure buttons. He knew how to get the best out of people. he knew how to get the best out of players with limited ability. He got every last bit out of it. And to be able to, I was really lucky because as well as having Roy McFarlane there as an experienced manager and a centre half who could sort of give you tips and sort of like you said, take you under his wing. You also had some good centre halves, some good defenders in Steve Blatherwick. Ian Everett was coming through at the time as well, and Shane Nicholson. So we had some good experienced players at the club for me to learn off of and watch how they went about their business day in, day out. So it was a great sort of learning experience and I suppose apprenticeship, especially that first season, where I only managed eight or nine games in the first team, but it was really a good learning experience for me and held me in good stead for the rest of my career.
Yeah. And kind of life around Saltergate at that time, that's kind of one of my favourite periods of being a Chesterfield fan. Because like you say, Roy McFarlane really overachieved as a manager. Like you say, he always managed to squeeze everything out of the players. And obviously that ground is a iconic ground amongst Chesterfield fans, even if it was a bit rough around the edges especially at that time. And then you had, like, I always remember going and buying tickets and Barry Hubbard being the ticket office, selling your tickets and stuff like that. Kind of, what were they like, the characters around the club at that time?
That's fantastic. It was unique, and it's not something that you see very often nowadays. And that there was a real, I don't know, family vibe, community vibe in the club. And like you say, you kind of knew who was doing everything, and who was doing, like you say, the chairman just selling tickets to the fans. It's, you don't see that at, Man United, do you? So it was that sort of connection that the fans felt with the club. They felt part of it. And I think we did, and we sensed that. And like you say, because we were it suited me, because Australians have like an underdog sort of mentality. So I could really relate to that underdog that, no one fancies us winning any game at that level at the time. But we did. We always did, and we had good players. We had players that were underestimated, I felt, and maybe underappreciated at the time. Now that, that the club finds itself, not necessarily where it finds itself now, but I think now you look back, you sort of appreciate how good some of the players were, and the level of competence that Roy McFarlane had to keep the football club sustainable, but also in League One comfortably, for numerous seasons, always tipped for relegation, and we always stayed up for quite a few years, and like I say, we flirted with playoffs numerous years, so done a great job, Roy McFarlane, and something that has held me in good stead now, looking back, as now I'm a coach, looking back at the job and the work that he did alongside Barry Hubbard in especially the club that had the financial problems they'd had before I'd arrived in 2001. The sustainability of the club was able to do, cut its cloth accordingly without giving extravagant wages out. It was a real good period. And like you say, it was one you enjoyed and one I definitely enjoyed.
Yeah. And there were some really fun players at that time as well. But I remember, he was kind of had a good knack of pulling out a loan signing or pulling a player out of the hat that no one had heard of. Like everyone, like since I started the podcast, everyone wants me to talk to like Chaman Toya, and then there's people like Jamie O'Hara came in on loan. There's your compatriot Jamie McMaster. Remember when he came in on loan? But there was some really good players that signed throughout that period, wasn't there? Some real surprises.
Absolutely, and I think that goes to show the contacts that Roy McFarlane had. He knew a player, could see a player, but also he could speak to numerous people in the game because of the career he had as a manager, but also as a player. He had numerous contacts that he could ring up and go, "We're after, a left winger," and all of a sudden Kevin Hurst would arrive, so you could get good quality players in, and he could wheel and deal really well. He could call in favors when needed. So that was a real and the strong point of Robin Farnham's was his recruitment. I'm not saying that because he signed me, but I'm just saying that because he could pick a player. So he was blessed in that department, definitely. And like I say, we had some great characters. We had a real team. I think that was a part of it as well, as the reason we could be successful at times and sustain League One football was because we had great characters, people who were willing to run that extra mile, run through a brick wall for the gaffer, for the club, and had a real work rate. You know, unassuming people like Derek Niven, who would cover, you know, 13, 14 kilometres in a game. You know, he might give the ball away a few times, but he'd definitely win it back and tackle. And he knew his role in the team. And people like that, you know, because they... and then if you did get the odd flair player like Chaman Toya in or Paul Hall in, you know, it was a good balance that we had in the group. And all the players got on well. We had a good age range as well, from experienced players like Blathers and Shinner and all the way down through to, you know, people like myself, like 19, 20, 21-year-olds coming through. So it was a good group of players and a fun time to be playing football. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And what kind of... So when you first joined us, what kind of personality was that squad? Because we were talking to Dwayne Mattis in one of the previous episodes, and he was saying that like the championship winning team was quite a quiet squad, and that sometimes you get real bantery type squads and sometimes they're a bit quieter. Back to those Saltergate days, what kind of personality was that squad?
Wasn't quiet, that's for sure. It wasn't quiet. I think we were lucky that we had probably five or six, well, seven or eight players all around 24 to 20 years old. So we were real pals, you know. And then we also had the experienced boys who had been there, done it, and they'd set good examples. They were good pros, so they'd set good examples for us. So we never took the mick, you know. We never, you know, messed about in training. Training was serious. Training was hard. Training was brilliant because you don't see it anymore. And it's not me being a dinosaur and me going, oh, back in my day. It was, you know, but you'd have an argument or a fight once a month, guaranteed, because it was so competitive. People were desperate to win. And that's what Roy McFarland instilled in you. He needed winners because he was a winner. He wouldn't hack it if you weren't winning. But at the same time, we had the professionalism to walk off the training ground and then put your arm around someone and go, we're all right, aren't we? And they go, yeah, of course, mate. Yeah, it's just, you know, I wanted to win, you want to win. Crack on, and that's it, you know. So that, we had them kind of characters. And then that was even, you know, even when people like Jack Lester joined and stuff like that, you know, them good pros who were desperate to win, you know, and that was the bedrock. That competitive spirit was always there. But, you know, we had some real good entertainers like Paul Hall, you know, he's brilliant in the change room, such a laugh. And, you know, would always get the, you know, can make light moment out of, you know, the heaviest defeat, you know, you bring the group back around. So people like, characters like that we had was so important. You know, like Dwayne was saying, you know, it was a bit more of a quieter group, the championship winning team when we won League Two. The first year at the new stadium, but still a great bunch of lads. People like Tommy Lee, Mark Allett, you know, Dwayne himself, and people like that. They were very professional, went about the business really well, and won the league because they were the best team. You know, we were the best team, you know, in the division, so deservedly won it. You know, some great players: Craig Davies, Jack Lester up front, you know, and Danny Whittaker, you know, so it was a good side.
So then kind of, I think it was probably the third season you were at Chesterfield that you became properly established in the team. Like 2006-07 season. And that's when we had the League Cup run, in which you got to pit yourself against some great strikers. I was having a flick through the kind of Man City, West Ham, Charlton games, and you were up against... Yeah. Like Georgios Samaras, Marlon Harewood, Bobby Zamora, Hasselbank, Sheringham, Darren and Marcus Bent as well. You came up against some big names, didn't you? In that run.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It was great, you know, as 21, 22, you know, to be able to you know, to have a go at players like that. You know, I'm a Leeds supporter, so, you know, memorable one is against Hasselbaink. I think he got double on the night, so I didn't do that good of a job against him. But no, to come up against someone like Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink was, you know, was brilliant for me as a Leeds supporter, watching him and, you know, growing up. So it was a great run. It was a great run. You know, we, you know, just seemed like everything was sort of, they were some of the best nights I think we had at Saltergate when we were having 8,000 fans there, not a seat or a standing place left. You know, it was absolutely packed. And, you know, the sort of, again, that giant killer underdog sort of status, you know, served us well for those games. And they were brilliant nights and deservedly won the games, I felt, you know, especially the West Ham and Man City games, you know. And, you know, we also, you know, played Wolves as well in that. So there was a couple of good games for us and for the club, and sure earned the club some much needed funds at the time, and give the fans something to cheer about.
He's done really well here to get into the box and to hang up a cross away by Rayner. Oh, what a strike! What a wonderful strike from Derek Niven! That is a fabulous goal of what is turning into a fabulous night for Chesterfield Football Club. You won't see a purer hit of the football anywhere, anytime. A goal to purr at, to smile at, to relish, to treasure from Derek Niven. It fell for him and he thundered it back. And Chesterfield, from behind, are on the verge of a major Carling Cup upset here.
It was a great cup run and season for me, but I think that was the year we got relegated.
Yeah, it was, yeah. But I think it's the season you won Player of the Year, but we got relegated. So is that...
Yeah,
How does that atmosphere-wise at the end of season do when you win Player of the Year, but you... been relegated, it must be kind of mixed feelings.
Yeah, I am a sort of by nature quite a team player, so everyone likes personal accolades, and you do, but you know, you do feel really guilty, you feel terrible, you feel horrible that the club's gone through a relegation. And you know, it was mixed emotions really, but more so it was quite frustrating and annoying that we'd sort of felt we'd let the club down a bit. So that was, it was tough. It was not a great year. And I remember it clear as day, Bradford City at home. We'd won the game and got relegated. So it was like, you know, it was really, really a horrible, somber atmosphere. And funnily enough, Bradford got relegated at the same time, you know, and we beat them and we both got relegated on the day, us and Bradford. So it was a tough atmosphere in that ground that day, that's for sure. So something that stuck with me, definitely. But like I say, the Player of the Year was nice, I suppose, you know, on a personal point of view, but didn't cover up the disappointment from the season. I think a pivotal point was obviously we got a good cup run, and then up till Christmas we were in the playoffs. And then it just really petered off, and unfortunately Roy had lost his job as well, so that was another, you know, real disappointing moment for me. You feel like you're letting a person down, a manager down. So that was someone who believed in me, and so, you know, you felt really guilty, you felt really bad. It was horrible. It's tough. Relegation's always that tough.
But to lighten it, was the Tokyo Spy Rights Award, was that always the best?
Yeah, it's a bit weird. I've got them somewhere in my kimono, and it's like a small cricket bat that you get as well, and a couple different dolls. It's definitely odd, but that's nice. Like I say, it is a lighter moment, but it's definitely an odd one of the most odd trophies you know, you receive, that's for sure.
They always got the biggest cheer in the ground when
they, yeah, exactly. Yeah, now the guys, to be fair, they're good guys and supporters.
So then like Lee Richardson took over. So what was the kind of style change in terms of how he managed the team? Because he's gone on to have an amazing career, hasn't he?
Yeah, fantastic. I think that was a big part that he wanted to bring in is the psychology side. You know, I remember early on in his moments, he was trying to sell a vision to us as far as this is where we want to go and things like that, and where he wants to take us. And obviously promotion was the aim after being relegated. And, you know, we kind of fancied our chances and we give it a good go. We fell just a little bit short, unfortunately. But the style change, I think he wanted to try and play a little bit more and try and move it through the thirds a little bit more and be a little bit... Roy wasn't a dinosaur by any means. He wanted to score goals and he wanted to attack and he wanted to make sure we were defensively sound. Lee was similar, but he wanted to sort of do it a little bit more controlled, I suppose. And he got some real good ideas into us and we played some real attacking football. He made some good signings as well. Obviously signing Rob Page, signing Jack Lester, Gregor Robertson. So players who went on to play for the club, you know, with distinction really, especially Jack and Gregor. So he made some good signings that year and we were close. I think we finished eighth or ninth or something that year, just outside playoffs, which was disappointing for us. It was a failure for us really, for where we wanted to be and what we felt we could achieve, especially for most of the season being in the playoffs pretty much all season and contending for an automatic spot. To fall away right at the end was disappointing. So wasn't one of my best seasons either. So yeah, it was a tough year. And you know, so yeah. But Lee was good. Like I say, he did try to introduce that psychology side, and he's gone on to do really well. Obviously with Liverpool now, and under Sam at West Ham and things like that. So he's done really well for himself, which is good to see.
Yeah, it's been really interesting as a fan, like seeing him move on from. All these different jobs. I think he worked in cricket for a bit, didn't he?
And
then moved on to different football clubs. Really interesting. Was he almost like a bit of ahead of his time, do you think?
I think in that aspect, yeah. Not many clubs at the time were looking to sort of that sports performance or, you know, sports psychology sort of. There was not at our level, you know. Obviously at Premier League, when you've got a lot more budget to do that. But at our level, obviously, Lee had done a degree in sports psychology himself. So he wanted to introduce that. So it was tough because there was a certain amount of resistance because of the age of some of the players. They sort of didn't see the value in it. At that time, I think everyone does now. So he was sort of working against a couple people as far as wanting to believe in it, because you really have to believe in it as a group and as a unit and embrace it and move it forward. And I think we did in some aspects, and it worked for, you know, it was good in some aspects. And like I say, Lee probably was ahead of his time. At that moment, but like I say, it was tough to bring something in that was foreign to a lot of people. So it was just trying to get that buy-in, and it didn't happen naturally. It was, you know, like I say, it was working against it a few times.
And then, kind of going on a little bit, you had obviously some really bad injuries, didn't you, that kept you out for quite a period of time. Cruciate ligament, wasn't it? And then you came back from it, and I think you had about seven or eight games, and then kind of did it again. But at that time, you kind of excelled in the community work and things like that. It seems like you were one of the players that that kind of wanted to keep busy and took the positives from it and kind of kept busy throughout that period. So, I mean, what's it like mentally as a footballer when you're out for such a long period of time? Is it hard to kind of pull yourself around and focus on other things?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously well documented. You know, numerous people have spoke about it, but it is about that. You know, when you're out injured, footballers, you are paid to play football, and when you're injured, it's something. You all of a sudden you become a gym buddy, really. You know, like you're in the gym 90% of the time, depending on the injury. Mine was very gym-based early on. So it was difficult because you just want to play football. But you've got to sort of look at it. That's where Lee, the sports psychology side that Lee did introduce, it made me think about it more and long-term picture rather than short-term. You know, if you concentrated on how horrible it is every day just being in the gym and not being outside, then it's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. But if you look at the long-term picture and go, right, if I knock off these next couple of days, weeks, whatever, then my long-term goal is back playing. And you, as long as you've got that light at that end of the tunnel and that process, you can sort of see and you lay it all out and see where you're at and then, you know, get that progress each day, each week, each month. Then it makes it easier. That made it easier for me to break it down. Like I say, I think I wanted to keep myself busy. So I was in the gym doing 2-3 sessions a day. So I was busy physically, but mentally I wanted to keep myself busy and tick it over. And so I thought, you know, if I've got 9 months till 6-7 months till I'm back, you know, use this time wisely, use it to obviously get physically in shape, but also mentally keep myself stimulated. So, my wife, Michelle, she's from Chesterfield, from North Wingfield. So, and all her family and things like that. So I bought into the community. Her father's a supporter of the football club. So I knew how important the football club played and the role it played in the community. So I wanted to be part of that. I didn't want to be sort of just, you know, someone who just, you know, comes in, does a session in the gym, goes home and nicks his money. I wanted to fully embrace myself into the club, into the community. So do anything I could to help out, you know, And also, I wanted to do a degree, some kind of education. So I did a sports journalism degree with the PFA. They help you out with things like that. So there was a 2-year course at Stafford University. So I did that and want to do some community work, commercial and radio work as well. So I did some other games. So just keep me busy and keep myself relevant, so people didn't forget about me at the same time. And also just to help out any way I could in the community. So it was important, and that helped me sometimes take my mind off of the thought that I'm out for. In the end, I think it was just over 2 years. So obviously, like you said, I played 7 games in between that. But you know, to do 2 ACLs, it can be mentally tough. So just keep myself strong, keep myself positive, and trying to use the time, like you've said, wisely, rather than, come the end of 2 years, I've not achieved anything. So at least I've got a degree out of it and got myself back playing. So, yeah.
So as a defender, I've always kind of wondered, because we've seen a few centre-backs before that have had kind of recurrence of kind of knee injuries, back injuries. You're doing a kind of repetitive things, aren't you? Jumping head in, especially kind of the McFarland era. And then there's obviously now the link as well with heading the ball and dementia and aspects like that. So now you're in coaching and looking back to your playing career. Has that kind of changed what you've thought in terms of coaching and training?
Some of the research has come out. I think there still needs to be a lot more that needs to go into it. It can be a controversial subject. My feelings on it is I'm not an expert, so I don't claim to be, and I'm just a footballer who's been through a 15-year career and now is in coaching. I do make a conscious effort that I feel heading is a massive part of the game, and if you're not good at heading, then that is somewhere that people will target, especially at the level I'm at now and the level above, League 2, National League, League 1. So it's a real important part of the game. So I'm not a neuroscientist or anything like that. I don't claim to be. So I don't know the effects that it has on children growing up. But what I am conscious of is that if they ban heading up until a certain age, I do worry that if they ban to, say, 12 years old, so then from 12 to 16, they're going to really condense heading so they'll do a lot more of it in a condensed period. So I worry that could have a detrimental effect in the long term as well, because if you've never headed a ball up until 12, then you're not going to be very good at it. Like you would be, you wouldn't be as good as say like kicking or striking a ball or passing or touch and technique, because heading is a technique. It is part of the game. If we take it away from the game, then the game's going to suffer massively, and it wouldn't be the game that we know now. It'd be very, it'd be very weird, very different. But that's not the subject. So I do worry that people will condense that heading from ages 12 to 16, 17, because by the time you get to 17, 18, if you can't head the ball effectively and aggressively and controlled, then you'll struggle to get into a first team.
Yeah.
Which some players do now, especially centre halves, fullbacks, centre forwards. So I do worry. I do make a as a coach, I do make a conscious effort to work on the technique with the players as far as heading in a restricted capacity. So it's not an hour session of me knocking balls from the halfway line and them heading it. You know, it's not that. It's more, we'll do sets of sort of two sets of six, get that timing, then we'll do it again later on in the week, things like that. So you're doing it over a longer term period because you're trying to improve the technique rather than trying to do everything condensed into one day. Yeah. So it's trying to, because it is still an important aspect of the game. So I definitely think my mindset's changed on the way I coach, especially pros, but even with the children, I think over a spread out period it's a lot more safer. But again, that's just my thoughts, yeah. Not any science, anything behind it. So until I think there needs to be more research done, I think there needs to be more a conscious effort of people to make that information available for coaches so that they can be doing the right thing, so we can help prevent dementia in long term. I do feel the balls have changed a lot since some of the ex-footballers that have got dementia now, unfortunately, are suffering with that now. I think the balls have changed. They've gotten a little bit lighter. They're not as heavy. They don't retain the water like they used to. So I do feel technology has improved that aspect, but like I say, until that research is made more widespread and more available, I think we need to make a conscious effort of not overdoing it, but at the same time not underdoing it and not condensing it into 2 or 3 years of constantly heading every day.
Yeah, totally. So then, like that change from Saltergate to B2Net, as it was then called. You obviously were kind of out at that period, but you were part of the squad that moved over to that new stadium. What was it? What was it like? Kind of the atmosphere of the players that moved, that were the lucky ones that moved from old stadium to new stadium over that period of time.
It was a great era. You know, I remember me and Scott, funnily enough, were just speaking the other day. It's a great era because obviously the way we went out, the Bournemouth game at home to Saltergate. It was a great day. It was a great atmosphere, great result, and very fitting that my mate Derek Niven got the winner, the last goal there. Jack Lester was gutted because he scored the first one in the game, and he wanted to have that record. But Niven, I thought, deserved it. You know, the service he showed to the club and that, and around that era. So it was fantastic that Niven was able to, Derek Niven was able to get that last goal, and then moving to the new stadium, obviously fresh, exciting. A good team, a good manager, a really exciting period for the football club, and that, you know, you could sense it. It was such a great season because, you know, we were, like I said, the best team in the league, and just felt like we won every week. You know, it just seemed easy. I know it wasn't. It definitely wasn't, and there were some tough games there, but it just seemed really easy, and it was like just got on a roll and just couldn't get off it. And it was meant to be. It was like fate, really. And to be a part of that from, you know, a sort of cheerleading point of view, to be sort of just, you know, congratulating the boys on their wins and that. And obviously with the injury, I wasn't able to be part of it too much, but it was good to be around them and join in and train and sort of the back end of it and be a part of it was really good. And it was, again, you know, being a coach, it was a good learning experience for me to now look back on that and know what it takes to win football leagues and to win championships. And yeah, it was a great atmosphere. And then obviously the end of season dues and, you know, and there's a great photo I've got here with all the players with Barry Hubbard in the middle of it, you know, and obviously with, you know, with what happened a couple of years ago, it's a great moment and memory that I've got of how it was great that Barry was part of that, you know, and, you know, because he'd suffered some dark moments with the football club and that was one of his brightest. So it's great that the chairman was able to be part of that.
Yeah, totally. It was just an incredible season. Like you say, everyone just went to the ground expecting to win every week and most weeks.
Yeah. The results were crazy, even like, you know, Crewe 5-5 and things like that. You know, we never knew we'll beat. You know, it was a great mental strength and the manager was brilliant. You know, John Sheridan was a very good manager and got the best out of the players and, you know, motivated them well. So it was good.
Yeah. And then the season after that was kind of the season that you left, wasn't it? You ended up going on, did you go on loan to Bristol Rovers?
I got back fit, worked over the whole summer. Jamie Ewart was brilliant, you know, and we worked really hard over the summer and got back. And it was always going to be a sort of transitional moment for me from being out for 2 years. Mm. You know, I was always going to take a little bit of time to find my feet and we'd moved up in the league. So I got myself a few games in the team. I think I got 13, 14 games in the team. And then I could sense the club and the manager moving a different way, which is fine, which is football. And I knew my time was numbered there. You could sense it. And then when Bristol Rovers come in for me, another great club, great history and tradition, just was struggling a little bit. They needed some help and I needed some games. I'd been out for 2 years. I just wanted to play. And probably rightly so, you know, I wasn't getting a game at Chesterfield. So it was sort of an opportunity that I thought was good for me to go and get some football games. And I did. So I went down to Bristol and loved it. You know, it was a good time for me there. So and it was a shame to see, while I was down there, it was a shame to see there was still a few struggles back at Chesterfield. So, but no, it was good to get myself in. It was weird because I'd only ever been at the one club for 8 years. So going to a new changing room, a new environment was different. It was nice in a way.
Yeah. Was it quite invigorating? Because I think you won.
Yeah.
You win player of the month in like your first month there, I think.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you probably asked that one. Oh, yeah. I think I might have done. Yeah, I might have done. So, no, it was good. It was a new lease of life. And sometimes you need to do that. And you can... not that it's anybody's fault, but sometimes you can be taken for granted when you're at a club for so long. And, you know, so you might set standards that you might not be able to keep to all the time. And I did struggle when I come back from injury, just trying to find some form, you know, because I've been out so long. So finding my feet was difficult. And obviously we've gone up a level that I wasn't quite used to at that time. So it was probably the right moment for me to move on.
Yeah. And then you ended up... you ended up moving to Torquay, didn't you? It's a long old way, isn't it, from Chesterfield to Torquay? So it was just like the upheaval as a human from having to... You can't really commute, can you, to Torquay? So what's the upheaval like as a person moving to a completely different place?
My kind of character doesn't bother me. I mean, we drive 4 hours for a pint of milk in Australia. So it's, you know, a big open country in Australia. It doesn't bother me, the travel and things like that. It was more so my wife, and I'm so glad she's such supportive of my career. And, you know, and she knew coming from Australia that, you know, it was all I wanted to do and all I wanted to be. So the opportunity arose. They'd been in the playoffs the year before, the 2 years previous, and, you know, had a good team and a good side, and they were centre half short and got the opportunity to go. So, you know, spoke to Michelle and we had a good chat, and I think she was ready for a change as well. She'd been at the football club at Chesterfield for 13 years, longer than me. So I think she also was ready for a a new venture and something different. So off we went, and it was great. You know, we only signed a year contract, so let's just go see how we go. Shall we, you know, go and have a year and see how we go. And if it doesn't work out, we come back and, you know, go from there. So we didn't sell the house. We rented it out and went down and just rented the place down there for a year. And it worked out well. You know, we had a good year down there and ended up staying for another 2 years after that. And we loved it down in Torquay. It's a beautiful part of the world. You know, it's, you know, beaches and long dog walks and, you know, they've got the Dartmoor National Park. And, you know, so it was a great time for me and Shell to go and, like you said, start something new, start fresh. And, you know, there's no sort of prejudgment or anything like that. You go in there and, you know, you can reinvent yourself, I suppose. And it was really good. It was really invigorating, is the word you said. And it was good. I really enjoyed it.
And this kind of, it's always the match that the fans look out for and hope that it's on bank holiday away at Torquay.
Yeah. Bank holiday.
There's a much worse place that you could end up, wasn't there, than Torquay?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first day I joined, I knew one of the players already who I'd been at Bristol Rovers with, and he says, let's go get some lunch, like, after training. I think it was my first or second day, and we went to this this restaurant that had like a balcony that overlooked the harbour, and it was about 27 degrees, sun beating down. We're sitting there having lunch, overlooking these yachts and albums, and I look, hell, mate, we've landed on our feet here, haven't we? So, it's, like I say, it's definitely some worse places to have moved to. So, no, I really enjoyed it. And it was sad leaving Chesterfield, I must admit, you know, because 8 years at the club, you know, that's when in your head you're thinking, can I get the 10 years? Can I get a testimonial in? Can I look to be, you know, get a few more games under my belt for that club? Because, you know, you wanted to reach sort of 200-300 appearances rather than not. The injuries hampered me. So it was a shame to leave. But, you know, looking back now, I feel it was probably the right time to move on.
Yeah. And then if we move on to the other club where you had success after leaving Chesterfield with Cheltenham, you kind of absolutely smashed the league that year, didn't you, at
Cheltenham?
So, I mean, was that probably your best season, your favourite season as a pro?
Yeah, it's tinged with a little bit of... It definitely is. But there's also a tinge of disappointment as well, because I'd done my third ACL in the middle of January. So I missed the back end of the season, which was disappointing. But no, it was a great season to be made captain, and then to lead the team to win in the league was a great honour, a great privilege, and like I say, a fantastic group of players, great bunch of lads, some of the, you know, mates I'll have for life out of that change room. So really, you know, privileged, happy to have been part of that. And grateful to have them players around me, and the manager at the time was also, you know, fantastic, best manager I've played under. So that was great to be a part of, and really enjoyed it. It was just, again, it was very similar to when won the league at Chesterfield. It's every week we won. We just never seemed to lose games, and I think we went on a club record 22 league games unbeaten. You know, which record still stands now. So it was a fantastic achievement from all of us. So, really enjoyable. And to lift the trophy at the end of the season as captain is a great honour. So, it was a good moment.
And kind of, instead of just saying really good players, what's the recipe that you need for winning a league? You know, is there little secrets of success to get that achievement?
Yes, yeah, there is. You know, there's a classic saying, you know, success leaves crumbs, you know, and you know, so when you are successful, you pick up things that, oh, that's worked. So there's a few things that we have, but I think one of the most important things is obviously the way you play, the kind of players you've got in, play the best way to them players, but the way you play is important, and your sort of end goal, what you want to achieve out of a football match is really important. But probably the biggest thing you need is ingredient you need is the characters in the change room. You need players who are desperate to win something. You don't want players who are coming in just to pick up a wage. So you need someone who's going to, you need players, a collective group of players that are desperate to win something. They're desperate to improve. They're desperate to win football matches and willing to put everything out there to do it. So that effort, that buy-in is so important, and that promotes team spirit. So, you know, winning football matches promotes team spirit, but at the same time, you need them characters and you need that spirit to stay alive when you are up against it, because no winning championship team has it easy the whole way through. It's hard for 90% of the time, and that 10% is that last final bit where, you know, it just seems automatic. You go out, you win a football match, the last four or five games, and you're over the line, and it's done. But leading up to that, there is blood, sweat, tears. There's, you know, changing room conversations, you know, that need to take place. There's, you know, when you're 2-0 down at half time, you need to come back and win 3-2. You're 1-0 down 5 minutes to go. You need to go and nick a draw or something. That character needs to be there, that belief, that determination. So all that ingredients needs to be there within the players, but it needs to be promoted from the top down. So the manager needs to have it, the assistant needs to have it. Then your experienced players need to embed that in the younger players, and the younger players need to be desperate to not let anybody down and be part of that and embrace that challenge, because it is a challenge, you know, and it is mentally a difficult 9 months. But once you've had it and once you've won a league, it's so contagious. It's so you want more. You want more. You know, you're not satisfied with just the one. So you need to get more and more. And that's so you're desperate to keep getting it. So once you get a few people in your team that have got that, you realise it's very much worth it.
Yeah. And you were kind of talking about it being contagious and having a wife that's worked at a football club. You definitely notice the change in everywhere else as well, don't you? When you have a successful team that's got that, just seems to have that something about it. You kind of notice that in the people working in the shop and the people at the ticket office and the fans and everyone else as well, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the year we won the league, the club, you know, was so successful off the pitch, you know, with the club shop. And obviously I knew directly how well that was doing because of my wife, Shell. But the conference and banqueting, obviously everything with the new stadium helps. But when you're winning football teams, people want to buy the shirt. People want to buy the badge. People want to come and have a meal. People want to spend more time at the club. They want to get there early and have a pie and a pint or a pie and a soft drink or whatever. They want to come and be a part of it. And you get all of a sudden, instead of you getting 5,000-6,000, you're getting 10,000, you know. So it's everyone wants to be part of success and say they were there when they won the league, or they were there for every game they won the division, you know. And you get your diehards, which are so important, and they're the bedrock of your football club. But then you get the few that will go along to have that sort of success, which is fine, which is not a problem. And so everything is so much happier when you're winning football matches. And it's about being patient when you're not winning at the same time, you know, because you can't come home and kick the cat or whatever and, you know, throw your toys out the pram every time you lose a football match, because you're going to lose football matches. It's part of the industry. So it's trying to stay on an even keel. But you do have to enjoy the good times.
Yeah.
You can't, people say stay, you know, on an even keel. You do, but when you are winning football matches, you still have to embrace it and enjoy it, because you do realise the tough times are going to come around the corner soon. So you've got to try and enjoy it while they're there. And then when the tough times do come, ride them out, you know, and stay positive and keep doing the right thing. So, it does make a big impact on everything in the community. It was like, say, that season we won the league at Chesterfield was had a massive impact on the whole town. It was brilliant, especially the open top bus tour and things like that at the end of the season. It just, you know, brings so much enjoyment to people's life. And that hard work that you put in, you know, Monday to Friday, is so worth it when you get the result on a Saturday and you can walk around the ground, maybe not at the minute, unfortunately, but you can walk around the ground and clap them and sort of walk out with your chest pumped out and your, you know, shoulders back and with a bit of pride and go, you know, I'm glad they've seen the effort we've put in and I've made them go, I'm happy, you know, and that's the most important thing.
As like an assistant manager now, what's the atmosphere like when you've not got fans in a stadium? I always wonder, does it make away games any easier or does it make home games any any harder?
I don't think it's made it. You don't have the ferocious away games, the crowds getting on top of you, things like that. From a coaching and tactical point of view, it's made it a little bit easier because you can get your information across to the players, so you can change things in game easier. Although everyone can hear what you're saying at the same time, so they kind of know. But you can make little tweaks. You can encourage easier, and you can give information clearer. So that has helped as far as that's concerned. And you can hear what players are saying more, so you can hear whether they're giving information, what information they are giving. So things like that you can take away from it. So to help improve the players off the pitch later, and you can say, well, you know, that was great talking there. I could really hear it. For instance, the goalkeeper, you kept the line high, well done, or the defenders are organising and things like that, or whatever. So there's that aspect from a coaching point of view has made it better. I wouldn't say better, but easier. It's what we have to constantly remind people is that although you might be alone in the stadium, every game's getting streamed now. So there's still 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people watching you. So you're not there and no one's going to, you know, not know. If you've made a good run and scored a goal, there's still, you know, 3,000 people in their front room jumping up and down, going silly, you know. So it does matter. So we have to keep reminding people that you're not alone, even though you are no fans out there. There's still a lot of fans watching the game and really, you know, hanging on an edge for whatever the result is. So it is important. So I think that helped. And I think people have gotten used to it now. It's been 6 months, you know, we were fortunate enough that we were in tier two, Torquay and Devon, throughout the sort of semi coming out of lockdown. Then we obviously went back into it. So we were able to have three home games with supporters. And that was brilliant. You know, we had some great games and some great atmosphere back in the ground. So we just really look forward to it all coming back. But it's not made it any difficult to go on away from home or at home. I think teams tactically still do subconsciously set up a little bit different, especially we're top of the league at the minute. So teams will naturally sit in a little bit deeper and try and, you know, force us to break them down at our place at home. So they do set up a little bit. Whereas when we go away from home, we find they're a little bit more freer and open. Which has benefited us, and there's more away victories than ever before in all the leagues, in all the divisions, and that I think that coincides with the freedom that teams have, whether they're home or away. They're not as cagey, I suppose, but there still is an aspect of that. So yeah, it's not a big difference, but the biggest one is, like I say, from a coaching point of view, it does make it a little bit easier at times.
A place to hide.
So
we're kind of coming to the end now. So it was interesting because obviously you did the sports media course. So everyone kind of expected you to be, especially after doing bits of co-commentary and stuff, you kind of moving into the media, and then you've ended up kind of doing coaching and then becoming an assistant manager. So have you kind of consciously thought about what the next step of your career is, or are you kind of just happy just to see where it goes?
It's very difficult to plan long-term a coach's career. I think if you start focusing too far in the future, you maybe lose sight of the present. Mm. I did the sports journalism degree because I needed to do something at the time. My very good friend Barry Roach had just done it. And he recommended it. So I thought, yeah, I'll jump on that. And it gives you something to do. And it gives you a real insight into the media and what they're looking to do, what angles they're trying to come at you with. So as far as interviewing questions as a assistant or as a manager or as a coach or whatever, then it does give you a little bit of a added edge to it, because you kind of know where they're coming from and what they're trying to get out of you. So sometimes you can just give it them, or sometimes you can go, no, I'm not giving that away, and I'll just keep sort of quite neutral with it. So it does give you an added edge, I suppose, with that, doing that. I was never sure what I wanted to do at that stage, I don't think. I love football. I always want to stay in football. As I progressed in my career, I suppose as a centre-half, you sort of naturally think about the game differently, and you really study it. I did anyways. So I think the natural progression was for me to go into coaching. And I enjoy it. I love it. It's one of them things you sort of, you dip your foot in the water and see what you think. And then, you know, I want to do more of it, and then more and more. And all of a sudden I knew I was going to retire early because of the injuries I had. So I ended up retiring at 32. And went on as a player coach role. So I was semi-retired, I suppose, but I was pretty much retired. Went on a player coach role, and I got the best of both. I could still join in the training when I needed to, but I took a few sessions here and there, and I took the defenders and did some defending sessions and things like that. So I was able to sort of ease my way into it that way and see what I thought and if I was any good at it or not. And Gary Johnson, obviously has seen something in me that he feels that, you know, he will benefit him and his team. So kept me about. And then obviously when he went to Torquay, he took me with him. So, and I'm trying to develop myself in that aspect now, as far as the assistant manager role and supporting him and trying to help him as much as possible to make sure we're successful. So I think that's the route I will go down now, as far as the coaching role. I think you see a lot of managers out of work go into media work to keep themselves busy and, you know, relevant. So that's always something you may look at. But as far as pursuing a media role full time, it's difficult because I think to make a living full time, they're generally going for an ex-Premier League player or an ex-Premier League manager or something like that, which I've not been in my career. I've not had a good enough a career to pursue that. You know, I'm not a big enough name. So I think I realised that quite early that I might have to look at something different. So that's why I've gone down a different route. And I was never good at writing. So it was always going to be, and I'm not the best looking fella in the world. So front of camera was going to be, so I thought I'll go down the coaching route because I enjoy that so much.
So as an ex-Chesterfield player, what's your message to the fans in terms of the career that you had and the support that you had?
So from my point of view, from my career, I mean, my message to them is a big thank you for embracing a young Australian coming over and embracing me as one of your own. You cop a bit of stick here and there, but it's warranted at times. But in general, I couldn't have asked for a better set of supporters to support me in everything that I ever did or was involved in at the football club. They, you know, through the injuries, they were always supportive. Every time I'd be, you know, walking my dog in Aslan Park, you know, and a supporter come up, right, down the way, you know, like everyone was nice, you know, and really embracing. And I've still got a family there now, you know, in my in-laws, and we still go back there regularly. Not at the minute, I'm not even back in months, obviously because of COVID reasons, but you know, when obviously everything eases off, we still go back there, you know, regularly. It's a place I'll always hold dear in my heart. It's probably a place I'll end up settling eventually at one stage or another. I love the area, and the football club was nothing but a massive part of my life and a brilliant part of my life. And I couldn't thank them enough for like I say, for everything they've done and support they give me. And it really, it got me on the footballing ladder. So I'm so grateful for the football club, for what they've done for me, but also the supporters.
And as Torquay assistant manager, what's your message to the Chesterfield fans?
Well, keep beating the teams around them, but don't go too well. You know, I'd take a double promotion so long as we go up automatic and you can sneak through in the playoffs if you want. But no, it's you know, it's good to see them a few smiles back on people's faces and a little bit of positivity around the club, because it has been a tough, a barren couple of years, and something I don't look upon fondly, I must say. But from a competitive point of view, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind what side I'm on. But, you know, there's obviously a nostalgic sort of place in my heart for the football club. So I wish them nothing but success, but not at my expense.